This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
And later on, the Janus attack. Don't mourn, organize, and fight back.
What the heck the Supreme Court did to working people in this country, and particularly people who are members of or have been members of public sector unions. We're going to look at the Janus attack. Don't mourn, organize, and fight back with Kimberly Bowski-Goldbaum, Chicago Teachers Union rank and file activist, member of the CTU Executive Board and the House of Delegates, member of Chicago AFT Black Caucus and the Caucus of Rank and File Educators, and just about everything else. Talking about activists, Kimberly, it's great to have you on.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And Chris Brooks, staff writer and organizer with Labor Notes magazine, most recently co-author of A Labor Notes Guide, Power in Open Shop America, and I think an enormously valuable and important article. It's one of the most comprehensive analysis I have seen, barring none, notwithstanding the Janus attack, but that's part of what we need to understand about Janus, which is how in heck's name we found ourselves to begin with in that position, and that's both an internal look at business unionism to some extent and certainly the external look, the collateral consequences of who really was behind and who financed the Janus attack, which went to the Supreme Court. And saying that, I want to begin with Chris and Kimberly, if you can both give us, just to begin with, your analysis in practical terms of what the Supreme Court did to public sector unions, how serious and critical it is to the organization of the working class. Chris, you want to get us started?
I would love to. Thank you both for having me on. This is a profoundly important conversation. What the Janus decision did is it nationalized so-called right-to-work conditions for all public employees across the United States. Since right-to-work is a propaganda term invented by corporate strategists, I would prefer to use the term open shop. In an open shop, workers have the option to receive the benefits of a union without having to be a member or paying a fee for union representation. They can choose to be a free rider. And in many cases, unions have a duty of fair representation. They're required to represent everyone in a bargaining unit, regardless of whether they're a member. What this is going to effectively do is require them to continue to provide the same level of services and representation for everybody while their budgets and membership are going to dwindle over time. The right's been very public about what their plan is and what they're trying to accomplish with this. They want to gut unions of members and money so that way they can have less influence on employers and on state elections. And then they hope to be able to elect even more sympathetic politicians. So once they're in office, the corporate interests can then pass state laws, which will torch what remains of many of the labor unions. Their hope is to pass Wisconsin-style attacks like Act 10 in states all around the country, like Illinois, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Minnesota. And in doing so, weakening the labor movement overall. And then that, in turn, will continue to shift the balance of power in society more and more to corporations and billionaires.
And Kimberly?
This definitely would mean that most of the benefits that we get as unionists would be in question, because our union wouldn't be able to handle some of the various responsibilities that our union takes on in order to protect our jobs. And so we were all concerned about this, and we've been concerned since the death of Justice Scalia and the Vergara case, kind of getting a reprieve there and trying to hit the ground running so that we could legally try to preserve our rights. This was, however, an expected decision. We expected the court to make a decision as it did. And luckily, the Chicago Teachers Union, we were all kind of on top of our game and trying to organize around preserving solidarity so that we could continue to go ahead and defend workers in the way that we have been doing. So I just want to say Mr. Brooks's article and this white paper that he's come up with is going to be incredibly useful, and there will be new workers that need to sign union cards. Our union, in anticipation of the decision that came down, we had a recard campaign, and we did this last September. We said that we anticipated that the decision would not go well for us in the Janus case, and we, all year, every school, and throughout all levels of the union made an outreach and an inreach to our various members and got almost 99% recarding, signing back up to join the Chicago Teachers Union. Now, I'm sure that with retirements and other things, some of those people will go, but that's an awesome amount of people and a very successful campaign, but we can't stop. We have to keep on going.
Chris, a lot of unions are doing what they're calling internal organizing and have been since the Friedrich's decision was cut down because Scalia died and then Janus came after that. Do you think that is enough? I mean, sometimes you're doing internal organizing, but there's no real activation of the membership, or is there?
Yeah, I think there's a range in the responses that we've seen to the pending Janus decision, which has now been realized. So I like to think of it as a spectrum from shallow to deep. On the shallow end is a lot of unions, for the very first time often, reached out to all of their members to get them to sign recommit cards through these all-in campaigns. So if they were going into the workplace and having those conversations, I think that that's a great initial step. But it can be pretty shallow because especially if the union's not been there in a long time, what comes up is a lot of issues, a lot of problems that workers are facing that they're then dumping onto the union representative or to the steward or whoever's having those conversations. What happens on the deeper side of the spectrum is that those conversations are used as an organizing opportunity, as a union building tool. Organizers can identify issues in the workplace that the workers can be united around in order to come up with a plan in order to solve it. And they can start identifying informal leaders, those people that have the respect of their coworkers, and that if they're engaged, they can bring their whole networks into the organization, into the union, into the plan of action. It's good to be on the shallow end if you've not done anything before, but it's not necessarily going to be enough, especially if you're facing some major right-wing opposition, like is being expected in states all across the country where corporate-funded right-wing organizations have been able to gather the personal contact information of many government employees and are now personally reaching out to them through emails, robocalls, and even door knocks, trying to encourage them to give themselves a raise by dropping the union.
Before we get into what is to be done, I think the two essential things to know is that Mr. Janus is not just an individual who felt that his speech was being limited by being in a union. Who financed this case? And really, what was at stake? Because it's part of a body of attacks against labor and organized labor and the public sector unions, which were holding stronger than the private sector unions. And I think in order to figure out where to go from here, it's critical to understand the full court press, if you will, that brought the case of Mr. Janus to the Supreme Court. Chris?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So currently, under about 7% of the private sector is unionized, while the public sector continues to retain a Canadian level of union density at about 33%. That has put it under the crosshairs of the right of corporations and business interest groups that are interested in undermining public services, in cutting taxes, and in trying to weaken the labor movement on the whole. So this case actually was originally brought by Illinois Governor Bruce Rauner, the billionaire governor who has been adamantly anti-working class, adamantly anti-union, passing a series of all these legislations and executive actions against unions, holding up the union, the state agency budgets in the state of Illinois for multiple years. When the court ruled that he didn't actually have standing to bring the trial, the Right to Work Foundation, you know, part of litany of right-wing organizations like the State Policy Network and the American Legislative Exchange Council are all funded by billionaires and corporations. They found a worker that would be willing to be the face of this. All of the lawyers, all of the politicians, all of the nonprofits, so-called nonprofits involved in this have been trying to push these kinds of cases through the courts for years. It's been a longstanding effort, and the end goal has been pretty clear. They want to use the judicial system in order to undermine basic rights that unions have enjoyed for decades in the hopes of further weakening working class power in the country.
And I want to cut to Kimberly Bowsky because certainly during the late 60s, early 70s, the last hired, so to speak, in First Fire were definitely women, were women of color, black and Latino women throughout the country. And they began to, after the struggles of the 60s, make breakthroughs and get hired positions. And a good part of the public sector unions are composed of women, women of color, etc. What does it mean to have had these unions and to have them not weakened by decisions like the Janus attack, which are both about decreasing the size of the treasury, but they're also demanding that people opt in to even be in the unions? What does it mean for you as a working woman and black women, Latina women, women of color, and all members of the working class to have had strong unions that were able to indeed use part of their treasury both for bread and butter issues to service their members, but also for political purposes that were in the interests of the working people that the unions represented? Kimberly?
Well, for your listeners, I am a black teacher of 26 years, a woman, and I would not be able to have a life-sustaining job with benefits without my union. So it's critical, because most of my friends, whether they're teachers or postal workers or other people that consider themselves part of the working class, we've really done well by unions, but we've fought to get into those unions and we fought to get the jobs that those unions protected. So it was the Janus decision, a direct attack on our neighborhoods, our communities, and our way of life. So it's critical for those of us who belong to those constituencies to make sure that our unions live. Oftentimes, especially for retired women in our CTU, many of whom are black, we went out and we did a lot of legislative work and talking out in communities. And we're doing this and we're volunteering to do this because we know the conditions that we have in the schools. It wasn't the Janus decision, then it's going to be privatization, like the privatization, the charterization of the schools in Chicago and the 2013 closing of 50 schools, and most of those schools were in black neighborhoods, and it did also affect Latina people. So we all think that unionism is the way to go, and we don't want to let our unions go without a fight. It really has been quite an experience seeing attack after attack and just having to kind of be a mainstay to our union. Our numbers as black women, and you know that our teachers union is mostly populated with women, but about 10 years ago, we had a union density of 49% black teachers, okay? As much as 20 years ago, I believe that was 49%. And now we're down to 19%. It is because of the efforts of this right wing of our government and anti-union forces that we're unable to maintain that level of employment. The union is the reason why we have been able to maintain about 19 to 20% union membership in the Chicago Teachers Union, if I could use us as an example. I think that it's critical that we stay in the fight. The union is the only way, solidarity is the only way that we're able to maintain our power.
One of the things that CTU has done so effectively is created student-centered demands that really focus on the composition and demographics of the students and how Rahm Emanuel's policies are disproportionately impacting working-class students and students of color, and been able to really lift those, connect them with the union's contract campaigns and with bargaining, with the demands that they're pushing. So it's not just that CTU is the greatest single barrier to the corporate takeover of public schools in Chicago, but it's also a force for the communities that it operates in. Kimberly's a force for the students that she teaches. And I think that's what's made them in part so powerful and put them in such a strong position to be able to withstand attacks like Janus.
Kimberly, just to follow through on a little bit more, because your union seems to be in, I won't say a unique situation, but a situation that we can really learn from, because as you said before, only 1% is non-union. You've been organizing for years and years to make the union more democratic, to involve the membership, and to do other things that you've mentioned in terms of reaching out to the community. So if you could tell us a little bit more about this, because I think people need to learn more about what the CTU has done and is doing, because it's really a model for what we must all be doing.
The leadership of the CTU is a strong leadership model because we insisted, and the caucus rank and file educators that took over in 2010, insisted that on working class kind of politics, that was part of a strength because it came with an analysis about the attacks on education being related to other things that were going on in the economy, period. And so we've been able to link up with different community organizations that have that same sort of idea. And so we realize that whatever happens to the school or in the school also happens other places. We tried and we continue to try to reach out to members to make sure that they're engaged and involved in community organizations with their students, that there's a great deal of interchange of ideas between us. And that's part of the leadership that we're doing. We try to strengthen the unity inside of our unions in the buildings, and we've really tried to get people to know the contract and then to act upon the contract and to know what the union is about. So it couldn't be done just by ourselves, but in conjunction with a whole lot of other things and keeping that analysis, being able to say that the privatizers that are attacking unions and attacking our jobs and attacking our students, everything that they've done in this language of freedom and choice. And we've been able to make the case to people that these are false choices and freedom is being misinterpreted. And with that message, we've been able to win a whole lot of things for workers and for students. And we've also reached out to other labor unions and also unorganized labor and day labor. We've been able to keep up those connections. All of that is critical to being successful as a teachers union that's established, but we can't do anything without other people. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, it certainly does, and we're going to continue on that because, you know, one of the things that certainly Kimberly and Chris have mentioned, we didn't say it in these terms, but it's clear that from what Kimberly and Chris were talking about, that there really is a racist history of right to work. It is not, let's be clear, because some people have been confused by the term, right to work is not the right for a job. It's not about equal employment. It is the mandate to work without the rights and the benefits of being able to collectively bargain to have a union and the interests of the working class on the line with and negotiate for the terms and conditions of employment with the employers. The right to work laws go all the way back to the 1940s as a strategy, really, to maintain Jim Crow in the South, which Chris points out beautifully in his article. I want you to also pick up, Chris, we wanted to be honest and self-observant. We see what Kimberly talks about what her union's doing to, and what she does to involve the membership for a more democratic and participatory process. But what have unions to some extent become lax about, even though we understand they're under major attacks from the right, but what have they become relaxed about that has allowed them to, or allowed the right to have an open door, or at least kick open the door a bit to really, along with this Supreme Court decision, truly erode their base and their possibility of functioning. And then we'll get about, we will not mourn or we will organize. And both Kimberly and Chris are going to talk about what do we do in the face of the Janus attack. Chris?
So what I would say is that after decades of demobilization, many public sector unions have become highly legalistic, service-focused organizations that overly rely on paid staff to perform the work of the union. This has often led them to be poorly situated to respond to the current crisis. If your members feel like they're being used as an ATM machine for predetermined priorities of the union leadership, that they didn't really get to have a say in it, then when they're given the chance to walk, they probably will. So this lack of a really deep connection to the members and what's happening in the worksite has left many unions, like the union leadership, kind of discombobulated and floating free of the membership. So what we've heard from Kimberly, what it takes to really rebuild the union from the ground up and the importance of thinking that the best response to Janus and to Right to Work or, you know, Open Shop is union transformation through union reform. And that means building strong unions that have a living presence day to day at the worksite, have stewards that are trained, that have identified the informal leaders in the workshop, that are having lots of organizing conversations, and that are actually coming up with plans to deal with the issues that their members care about on a day-to-day basis, while also trying to fight for bigger and bolder visions, right, of what they can accomplish. I think that Kimberly was just saying matches up perfectly with that, like having to engage in the school site fight, having to take on the bullying principle that's there, while also trying to think about how can we make bigger and bolder demands at the bargaining table. I mean, one of the things that's been so incredible about the CTU is that in their last round of bargaining, they were making demands that weren't even legal. They don't care. They were saying that we want the city to open up its tax base and more funding into public education, and they knew that they had the public support on their side. And the city ended up caving, even though making such a demand isn't legal under the collective bargaining laws that exist in Illinois. So I think CTU is such a great example of how they've been able to build from the base and then scale up and project a vision for what it looked like to transform their city.
I wonder if we can build on the model for the Chicago teachers, because everybody is now open shop. What they used to call right to work, we call open shop. And there's been a lot of open shop in the private sector for years. And in some cases, this has not weakened, or it has not killed, at least, the unions. For instance, the Nevada hotel workers are all open shop, but it's a very strong union. The post office, among the federal employees, a lot of the federal employee unions have very low union membership. But the post office has like 90%. So what is it that people should be looking at? In addition, I don't think it's just the Chicago teachers. What other role models do we have out there for this open shop environment?
LaborNotes just produced a guide. So it's called Rebuilding Power in Open Shop America, and it's available at our website, labornotes.org. In it, we tried to identify what unions that are not only surviving but thriving in right-to-work environments are doing. What are they doing right? How are they being able to build membership and continuing to win fights? And we found that there was some commonalities between them. You know, we said they needed to be democratic. So strong organizing, identifying those issues that members care about is inherently about engaging them and getting them involved. So unions have to be democratic organizations that are constantly reaching out, winning people over, and never writing them off, even if they're not a member. They also have to fight the boss. I mean, it's just an inherent part of the work is being able to say that there is a person that's creating these issues, that's creating these problems, and we can take them on. We can identify them. They have names and addresses. We can hunt them down. And they have to be able to come up with a plan.
I have a couple of suggestions,
Kimberly,
too.
Sure.
LaborNotes does have a book called The Secrets of a Successful Organizer that gives people scenarios of situations that they might find at work. I mean, it doesn't matter if you're CTU or not. Just if you're a worker, these are things that you could do to organize your workplace. And if you're having problems knowing what kind of conversations to start, they give different examples, and they also give real-life kind of history and examples. The other thing that people could do is look to the past. You don't have to mimic the past totally, but there's some good ideas. There's some old-time unionism. Going from door to door is a good idea, but when you're in the workplace, there goes your door, the person that works with you or next to you or somewhere in the physical plant, if you would call it that, or your office. That's a person to go to and have conversations about what's going on when they feel safe to do so. We took a tip from the past also, meaning the CTU, and we have a research department and an organizing department. There are numbers and strategies and things that get done there. I also say for people who are not totally unionized, like where the red states were, where all those teachers went out fabulously, they went person to person, and they also used social media. So there are a lot of options that we could use, and especially communication.
So while we need more robust treasuries for sure, the key is not just the money, and we're not trying to rationalize things. We are trying to make sure that the glass is half full rather than half empty. And both Kimberly and Chris have given us ideas about what we do. We don't mourn, we organize. And it would seem that what you're both talking about is a more direct participatory role with the membership. And then the question is, who is the leadership and to what extent they really meld with and are and percolate up from the membership base? And since Kimberly mentioned also the issue of the teachers, one of the things that happened with the teachers in those red states were they really worked in conjunction with the community. They built really meaningful
alliances.
The
demands also were for the community.
Absolutely.
For the students.
Yeah. So they came much more cohesively and directly and comprehensively from the grassroots themselves, and were bread and butter issues, but they were and the teachers' issues weren't as much bread and butter issues as they were about the nature of education. So would you both, in the final time that we have left, say that what we do for those of us who uphold the working class, for those of us who uphold the union, how do you look, both of you, at those key ingredients in a post-Janus era to take us to really regaining the membership, enlisting more people, and making the unions the powerful bulwark against capital that they should be? Chris, Kimberly?
The answers come from so many different places. We need to stay the course, meaning just because someone passes a law doesn't necessarily mean that we can't overcome that. We have to keep it in our minds and tell our colleagues, our coworkers, our comrades that in the history of this country, there have been many laws that have been unjust. There have been many decisions that have been unjust, and they don't define our union. We define our unions. We have to reach for aspiration and inspiration, right? We're the ones who do the work. And so we aren't just employed. We are workers. People have to start thinking in two minds. You're not just an employee that has to take orders and produce. That's your work, and you have some say about it. So I think that we need to get people on board, and it's a continual process to try to organize, to fight the bosses, to even argue with each other, because just because you have some successes doesn't mean that everybody's at the same developmental stage or that they're with you. We need to continue to do the recommitment, the recarding campaigns. We need to encourage people to start unions. Make sure that we're reaching out to those who are unorganized and those who are frightened at what this means, because we know that when we have unionized workplaces, the conditions get better for those who are not in organized.
Just want to let Chris, next 30 seconds, add on to that, and of course tell us where we can get all this fabulous literature that we've referenced and that Kimberly has referenced. Chris Brooks, the last word.
Yeah, if you had told me in January that we would see a wave of illegal teacher strikes in Republican-controlled states, I wouldn't have believed you. Yet here we are. Things can change very quickly. Our members are non-apathetic. They're willing to take risk and fight for big, bold demands, and that's very clear. So I think we need to build on that momentum. So if you want to find the Labor Notes Guide to Surviving in Open Shop America, you can go to labornotes.org. And then I also have a piece up on the right-wing plan to build on Janus to demolish unions up at In These Times.
And it's fabulous. I can't thank Kimberly Bosky-Goldbaum, Chicago Teachers Union, enough, and Chris Brooks, staff writer and organizer with Labor Notes. And Ken and I were just going to add, don't mourn, organize, because you have nothing to lose but your chains.
And we have a world to win.
With people like Kimberly and Chris, we will do just that. Thank you both for joining us, and I'm optimistic that we're going to be rebuilding and strengthening our unions. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.